From KHOI 89.1 in Story City, Ames, I'm Chris Fibura, and this is Book Central, the show that interviews authors from the Central Time Zone. My guest today on Book Central is Scott Russell Sanders, author of the new book, Dancing in Dreamtime, a collection of science fiction. Scott collects an opus of somber and satirical stories about the conflicts between humans and nature, here on Earth and across the universe. Scott is Distinguished Professor Emeritus of English at Indiana University, Bloomington. Scott Russell Sanders, welcome to Book Central.
I'm glad to be talking with folks there.
Scott, you grew up in Indiana, fascinated with rocks and space travel. From those combined interests, I imagined these stories excavated from a quarry, or that this collection lifted off from a launch pad. How would you describe the container, this book, for your sci-fi stories?
Well, actually, there's just one little correction there, Chris.
Sure.
I grew up in the sort of circumstances you described, but it was in Ohio. I've spent my adult life in South Central Indiana, in Bloomington, Indiana, and limestone country, hilly hardwood forest country. But I grew up actually in northeastern Ohio, part of the time on a military base. And I mentioned that because one of the stories in the collection, a story called Sleepwalker, draws on memories from growing up in that military base. But to describe the overall book, this is a collection of science fiction stories, which I wrote in the 1980s and 1990s. They were all published in the leading science fiction magazines of the time, magazines like Fantasy and Science Fiction, Isaac Asimov Science Fiction Magazine, New Dimensions, and I never tried to collect them into a book, but a few years ago I looked through the stack of the magazines in which they originally appeared and thought, well, I'm going to reread them and see whether I feel they hold up all this time later, and hold up in two senses. On the one hand, do I still feel that the writing is strong enough to reprint them between the covers of a book? And secondly, are the issues that I was wrestling with, social and environmental issues that I was wrestling with in writing those stories originally, do they still seem pertinent? And my response after I reread the stories was both that the writing held up, although I did a fair amount of revising before I put the book together. And if anything, the issues that I was addressing, social and environmental issues that I was addressing when I wrote the stories originally, have only become more pronounced and more urgent, and my response to them more urgent over time. So that was what prompted me, that combination of reactions prompted me to gather these stories for the first time into a book so that readers could see them all next to one another in the context of one another.
Right, exactly. And so in many of these stories, you question the promise of speculative innovations. For instance, humans will be protected in domed cities, but should we be blocked off from nature? We will travel quickly in sealed tubes from city to city, but should we not slow down for the ocean and sky so we may feel the water in the air? We will be able to pet tamed mechanical beasts, but what do we lose without experiencing their realness? I could see these questions still being relevant that might not be here yet, but might be here soon. And, you know, there were several questions that I wondered about innovation. One was, what's an innovation that you wrote that actually became real and you wish wasn't here?
Well,
there's a lot of them, right?
Yeah, there are a lot of them. The domed cities in which characters live in stories such as The Engineer of Beasts and Terrarium, and stories both of which were later developed into novels, which we could talk about later if you'd like. The domed cities were a projection of shopping malls. And after I wrote those original stories, the Mall of America in Minnesota and also other enormous malls around the world were built. And they're enclosed spaces within which one can literally, in some cases, be born, live an entire life, and be buried. You have hospitals, you have schools, you have, of course, every source of consumption. That enclosed world, the world where we are surrounded entirely by human artifice, where nothing natural is admitted other than our own bodies, that theme, which is developed in a number of the stories in this book, has been played out in the quote-unquote real world, big time, in the various malls around the world. Other phenomena that I drew on in the book have become more pronounced. For example, the story Ascension tells about a town where the people are suffering so much from increased temperature, from rising temperature, that they undergo a kind of collective madness. There's a comic dimension to that story, as there is to a number of the stories in the collection, but the underlying concern is a very real one. And I was writing with an awareness of climate disruption and global warming. I was writing with an awareness of that in the 1980s. And that wasn't because I had any profound insight. In fact, I was simply reading the scientific literature of the time, mainly popular science. A lot of the appearance of kind of prophetic vision on the part of writers like Philip K. Dick and so forth is actually the result of paying attention to what the scientists were telling us. And a lot of the trends that I wrote about in the collection, in these various stories, a lot of the trends were ones that were being identified by scientists who were out there. They're like the feelers for the human population. They're out there monitoring changes in the world. And I have been fascinated by the work of science my entire life, since I first began exploring it as a child.
And so, you know, there are these enclosures that obviously have come to be real, that we have these malls that ensnare us, trap us, keep us. But then I also wondered whether or not there were innovations that you did write about that aren't here yet, that you actually do wish were here.
Well, there are a couple that I think we're on the way towards, but we haven't quite reached yet. For example, in the story called Travels in the Interior, two brothers earn their living by traveling to Earth-like planets, and one brother arranges all the logistics of the travels and so forth and acts more or less like the guard for the two of them, because they're going into conditions where they never know what dangers they might confront. And the other brother is the explorer, and he has implanted at the base of his skull a transmitter, which is picking up his neurological patterns from his brain. And those are beamed to Earth, and the recordings of his neurological patterns are then turned into virtual reality films. Well, we don't have a device yet that will be able to turn neurological patterns, that basically the electrical activity of the human brain, to turn those directly into experiences that other people can share. But we are certainly infatuated with so-called reality shows, where people are living vicariously through, whether it's police making a drug bust or firemen putting out a fire or whatever, soldiers in a battlefield, that taste for vicarious adventure delivered electronically, not through reading a great novel and not even through watching a conventional film, which we've had, of course, for a century now, but rather through some sort of direct recording of people doing something that we like to vicariously experience, but we would not actually like to have the experience ourselves. So we don't yet have the technology to produce a reality show directly from a person's brain. But the the ability to monitor electrical activity in the brain is very sophisticated and advanced now, and the taste in viewers, in consumers, if you will, the taste for so-called reality shows and virtual experiences is very pronounced. So that's an example of a projection that I made in a story 30 years ago or 20 years ago when it was first written, a projection that hasn't fully come to pass, but all of the pieces are in place for making it a potential future reality.
And it's almost here. You know, there's the chips that you can implant. Oh, I've heard about it in people's hands or in their necks. We do have these reality shows. We do have 4D cameras to be able to just do a 3D camera, excuse me, that goes all around somebody, and you can immerse yourself in the world of it. And video games have been around for a while. So it's almost this braid of convergences that's on its way that, like you said, might not or maybe should not be considered prophetic, but we were headed in this trajectory for quite some time.
Yes, very well said. When I read about developments in technology and developments in science, like most other people, I can be very impressed by the ingenuity and by the amazing things that technology can bring to us. In the 1950s, I would read it when I was a very young child. I would read funny papers about a character named Dick Tracy, who was a detective.
Sure.
And one of the fascinating things about Dick Tracy was that he had a watch that was actually like a little TV and a radio and a phone.
Like an Apple Watch.
Exactly. And I became very interested in computers when I was maybe 12, 14 years old, when they were the size of a gymnasium, and they were only owned by IBM and the Pentagon and, you know, a few other big institutions. And now we can carry around in our pockets a device that will connect us to the World Wide Web, that will phone anywhere in the world, et cetera, and take photographs, give us maps. And like anyone else, I can admire the ingenuity that lies behind these devices. It's ingenuity, by the way, that was not, for example, Apple's ingenuity alone or Microsoft's or any one company's. This is a collection. The creation of a phone in our pocket that's also a computer is the result of literally thousands of human discoveries stretching over centuries and all around the world, from metallurgy to the invention of digital computing. So every new technological development is the fruit of, the outcome of, decades, if not centuries, of discoveries. So I admire that. And I use a phone. We're using not a cell phone at the moment, but a landline. But I use a computer. There's one on next to me on my desk right at this moment. At the same time, I am concerned about, I think worried about is not too strong a term, I am worried about some of the negative effects of our increasing dependence on technology. Because the net effect of all of these technological innovations is to divorce us more and more completely from the natural world. And the natural world, whether we like it or not, is the real world. It's the ultimate world. Its rules, its patterns, its orders, its boundaries are not negotiable.
And so we've lost this connection. And you've written about all these innovations, many that have become real, such as screen phones, these giant malls, space tourism. And, you know, you've talked a little bit about what you think about the future here and consumption and other ways to live life. But you also, switching from a somber to a satirical perspective, you also humorously explore certain people and things that we do. For instance, you have this gastronomical, inspirational obese man who paints the ceiling of a mall filled with fast food stores and liposuction clinics in your story, The Artist of Hunger.
Yes.
And this man, Sir Toby Moore, illustrates the sun as a pat of butter melding into mashed potato-shaped clouds. But under the satire, you know, you always do return to the sinister situation where in this story, the military has sold the technology for mood programming to the mall. So while people eat, they feel ravenous while they also feel ashamed. And they go through this trough to vacuum, filling and emptying themselves of fat. Can you recall, you mentioned about reading through your stories again. And I wonder, as a writer reading his own writing, how did you feel emotionally when you were reading these stories?
Well, this story cuts close to home. I'll be personal here. My sister is overweight. I have an older sister, a wonderful, beloved sister named Sandra. And she was overweight in elementary school, and this led other kids to pick on her and make fun of her. Now, remembering what she was like, and I can also look at photographs, she would be a typical fourth grader, fifth grader, sixth grader. She wouldn't be regarded as overweight at all. But her life was made miserable because of she wasn't slender the way the other kids were. Within my lifetime, if you look back, say at the end of World War II, I was born right a couple of months after the end of World War II in 1945. If you look at news reels of people in the streets, people in stores, people on ships from that time, the first thing you notice is they're lean, they're slender. There are no enormously fat people. Now, here we go from 1945 to 2016. You go to your local mall, and what you're going to see is the average person is probably anywhere between 20 and 50 pounds overweight. And this is not just older people. You'll see this in teenagers. You'll see it young children. You'll see it in people in the prime of their life, their physical prime of their life. So this obesity actually arises from a fairly simple reality. We're less active and we eat more calories. It's real simple. Now, so the question is, why do we eat more calories? We eat more calories because almost all the foods that are prepared foods have extra calories in them in the form of either fat or sugar. And selling the stuff to us, the stuff that's actually ruining our health, is a huge business. I mean, think about the amount of advertising that's devoted to pushing soft drinks or pushing fast food or pushing pizza. And then think about the amount of money that is made through all the diet programs, the Weight Watchers, and et cetera, et cetera. And on the one hand, merchants make a lot of money by selling us stuff, much of which is bad for us, and then other people make a lot of money by people's efforts to undo the effects of eating what the first set of merchants have sold to us. That's exactly the situation in the story that you refer to, the one called The Artist of Hunger. The technological slant on it is that my central character there, Sir Toby Moore, and that name, in fact, is simply a commercial name. It's not his actual name. His art is to create skies that are projected on the domes of these cities where people live, or in malls where people live, and embedded in those, unbeknownst to him, embedded in those projected skies are advertisements for various kinds of foods, and then advertisements for various ways of dealing with obesity. And so I wrote that originally about 30 years ago, and the rate of obesity has continued without stop since about the time I wrote the story.
And it's this cycle of happiness and shame, this emotional feedback loop that how do you, you know, break out of it? And we're going to explore a little bit more of those kind of questions here. We're going to take a short break. You're listening to Book Central. Support for this program is provided by Plot Twist Bookstore in Ankeny, a place where book lovers can browse, talk, and meet. Open daily. For hours and more information, go to plottwistbookstore.com. We're back. If you're just joining us, my guest today is Scott Russell Sanders, author of Dancing and Dreamtime. Before the break, we were talking about the origins and innovations in his science fiction stories. Scott, several of your stories possess characters with prevision, deja vu, or some imprinted memory from the past. One of those characters is a draftee in a story called Sleepwalker. This man becomes aware of a predetermined routine that he relives the same day over and over again. Every day he is cleared fit for war. Why was it important for the character to relive that day? Not the day he goes to war, or maybe the day he would die at war, but the day he can go to war.
Well, in many ways, Sleepwalker is the most autobiographical of all the stories in the collection. I was a conscientious objector during the Vietnam War, but at the time I registered for the draft, my official residence was my family's home, which was in Louisiana. And my draft board had never granted a conscientious objector status. I was willing to do alternative service, but they simply wanted to get rid of me. They wouldn't grant CO status. And so what they did was simply to dismiss me, to treat me as unfit to serve. And that always troubled me. It troubled me that I didn't get a chance to do alternative service because I had friends, I had schoolmates who went to Vietnam, I had several friends who died in Vietnam. It was a war that I was vehemently opposed to and continue to be vehemently opposed to. So part of the characters, the lead characters' experiences in Sleepwalker are ones that I went through in terms of medical exams and the anxiety and trying to decide whether to go to Canada or Sweden, as a lot of objectors did at the time, whether to go to jail. I was married at the time I was going through it, as is the character mm-hmm. in the story. So that's one of the impulses behind the story was simply my own experience. But a deeper, or I guess I would say a more significant impulse was to invite the reader to think about the fact that the United States has been more or less perpetually at war since World War II. We know about the big wars, like the Korean War and the Vietnam War and now the Iraq and Afghanistan wars. But if one looks at the history carefully, one realizes that U.S. military troops have been places in the world, Central America, Africa, Asia, continuously, often fighting battles on their own, often assisting or advising government troops. So we are in fact a highly, highly militarized society. We like to think of ourselves as a peaceful people. We simply want the world to be at peace, and that's why we have a military. But in fact, we are the most militarized and ultimately the most violent nation on the planet. And that's the simple fact. And it troubles me deeply that there is this distance between our perceptions of ourselves as a peace-loving people and the fact of the matter, which is we are a war-making people. We see violence and force as the way of imposing our will on other countries. So this story, the deja vu dimension of it, is a way of suggesting the perpetual nature of our warfare and calling it to the character's attention, who feels that he's somehow reliving this day over and over again, and also calling it to the attention of readers.
That we're always prepared for war and that we're just a nation that is... I don't know if we would call ourselves fit, but that we're ready to send our people to other countries. I didn't know that that was such a personal story. That's one of the only ones in there, that one of three, I think, that is written in first person.
Yes.
And conversely to the draftee in Sleepwalker, you've got another character, Jason Moss, in the story, The First Journey of Jason Moss, who's this accountant from Buda, Indiana, a perfect city name, becomes a world traveler who, after surviving a fall out of a tree unharmed, he explores the world that he didn't know. And so in that story, I was able to read Jason Moss as this allegory between maybe the freedom of adventure and travel, the freedom in writing, the freedom in reading. You gain a new lens of experience to view your old life by. So how is writing for you influenced, though, by your travels and your reading, the freedom of both of those?
Well, I'm glad that you mentioned The First Journey of Jason Moss, Chris, because some people who've read the book feel that it somehow doesn't fit, that it's so significantly different from the other books. And it is different in the sense that it doesn't take place on another planet, doesn't take place in the future, involves no sophisticated technology, but it's, to my mind, deeply integrated in the concerns of the book, partly because of what you identify, the choices that Jason Moss is making as he travels around the world. Here's a man who comes from a little tiny settlement in Indiana. There is actually a settlement in Indiana called Buda, Indiana. And he decides, as he's falling from the tree, having led a very, very confined, orderly life, never traveling, never taking risks, being very tidy in his life, he decides that if he survives this fall, that he will travel around the world. And his first notion is that he will actually walk around the world, and when he gets to a body of water, he'll take a ship.
Right, a million steps a month.
Yes. Yeah, he calculates how many steps it will take him to go. And he, as he sets out from his little village on this quest, and it is a story about a quest, as he sets out, he meets up with a woman named Doris Wilkins, who raises chickens and hauls chickens to the market. And they have a little conversation, and then he goes on his journey. And as he travels around the world, he keeps meeting people who see in him, who perceive in him a kind of generosity and openness. And so they ask him to run errands for them. A little girl asks if he will buy a Shetland pony when he goes near the Shetland Islands, and her daddy will pay for it. There are various gifts to be delivered. And Jason Moss is in some ways kind of like St. Francis. He's a sort of totally innocent and in some ways rather simple
yes.
human. And so as people come to him with their various questions or their various needs, he simply takes them on and fulfills them as best he can. And over the course of his journey, it occurs to him that he should check to see when he goes through a city like Berlin, at general delivery, if perhaps any mail has come for him. And what he starts discovering is that this woman, the chicken lady, Doris Wilkins, has sent him postcards. They're all identical, except they have different numbers. And in total, she sent him 500 postcards saying that she will meet him in Japan on a certain day. And for a long time, he thinks of this as simply impossible. There's no way whatsoever that he's going to meet this woman in Japan. And eventually he does. And then they travel together to complete his circuit of the world. It's a mildly funny story.
Mm-hmm.
And it is, I think, you refer to it as, or you see it as an allegory. I think it is an allegory that has a couple of themes that are close to my heart. One is our responsibility to other people. Jason Moss is somebody who simply takes on other people's needs, and they're drawn to him because they recognize that in him. And I do think that we are responsible to other people, to help other people, to alleviate their suffering. The other allegorical theme, I suppose, is that the quest he's on to go elsewhere to see new things finally enables him to recognize that the place he came from, not necessarily the village of Buddha, but the life situation he came from, is just as capable of providing meaning and satisfaction as any other place that he might go.
And with that story, it's really about discovering how there's another world on our world.
Yes.
That it's the same kind of travel elsewhere to another planet, but that can just happen here.
Yes, yes.
And I wondered more about travel. You have this character, Zuni Franklin, from the story Quarantine. She's the architect of the enclosure, the domed city. And in her retirement, she plans to go on a journey into the wild. And I wondered about these two books that she took. They might have been books that you would have taken. Rachel Carson's The Edge of the Sea and Barry Yes. Lopez's Elegy for the Whales. And let's say if you were sent to the enclosure rather than the wilds, and you could only take two books, one for each hand maybe, then what would they be and why?
Oh, yeah, that's a hard question. A good one, but a hard question. The first book that comes to mind is a very predictable one, I suppose, and that's Thoreau's Walden. And the other book, which may also be totally predictable, would be Shakespeare's plays.
Oh.
And which I've always loved. But I suppose Shakespeare's plays would represent for me the power of stories. He was one of the greatest of human storytellers, although there have been many, many other great ones, many of whose books I have read and been nourished by. So Shakespeare would be taking human stories with me into the enclosure to remind me about insights into our nature, our human nature. And I would be taking Walden, Thoreau's Walden, in because I feel that it remains the single most potent reflection on what nature is that any writer, certainly any American writer, has ever created.
And reading requires a similar solitude that is found in nature. I believe that reading is just as difficult to defend as nature. We're going to take another short break here. You're listening to Book Central. This program is supported by Humanities Iowa and the National Endowment for the Humanities. The views and opinions expressed by this program do not necessarily reflect those of Humanities Iowa or the National Endowment for the Humanities. We're back with my guest, Scott Russell Sanders. His new book of collected science fiction stories is Dancing in Dreamtime. We were talking about fate and freedom, travel and reading, and nature. Scott, several of these stories you wrote into novels. I'm not sure if you linked them together or you just expanded the narrative. What questions called you from your short stories that you wanted to give a longer answer to in the form of a novel?
Well, the first of these stories that I wrote that later was expanded into a novel is the one called Terrarium. And the ultimate novel has the same title, Terrarium. And then I wrote a couple of others, actually I think three others that are in this collection. That is three other stories which overlapped with the world of Terrarium. Many science fiction writers will create, a future world, and then will situate a series of stories or a series of novels in that world. And I did that in the sense that what I call the enclosure, mm-hmm. which was a global network of domed cities, some of them on the oceans, some of them on the land, domed cities that are connected by travel tubes, and that's called the enclosure, and humans have moved into it sometime late in the 21st century. They've moved into it because the outside world, the world that you and I are actually sitting in at the moment, right, breathing air and so on, the outside world has been so contaminated and so degraded that humans, that Earth has in effect become a hostile planet, and entirely through human abuse. So that enclosure world was the background for Terrarium, and I became interested in exploring that background world more fully. I also became interested in the group of rebels who are introduced in the story Terrarium. Mm-hmm. And they are people who work as a repair crew. They go outside the domes, you know, to work repairs on the human system, on the enclosure. And they all want to go out and live full-time out in what's known as the wilds, the world outside the human enclosure. And they, in the story, they are conspiring about going out. And then the story ends. There's a love story embedded in it, and the story ends without the reader knowing, and for that matter, in my case, the writer knowing whether they will actually go outside and establish a colony in the wilds. And so I explored that in two novels, actually. One, that, as I mentioned, called Terrarium, and another one called The Engineer of Beasts.
Right, and in that one, I did wonder about how did you expand or contract the idea that wildness is dangerous enough that you could die from it?
Well, if you think about the trajectory of human experience, we have insulated ourselves more and more fully from the wilds. We've created shelters, and then we've created shelters that are artificially lit and heated and cooled. We've created vehicles to transport us across the land with windows up and music playing and air conditioner running and telephones available. We've created malls that are enclosed where one can spend, you know, the entire day and never see anything that is not made by human beings. And that I participate in that. I live in a house. I'm using a light over my desk at the moment. It's rainy here in southern Indiana, and so we've closed the windows. So, but of course, the ultimate nature that we can't get away from is our bodies. Our bodies are, in fact, I think of the human body as an ecosystem, because our human cells, our specifically human cells, have within them a co-evolved species called mitochondria. Every single human cell has mitochondria in it, which is not human. We have tens of thousands of species of microbes in our bodies to help us digest and so on. So we're like these walking wildernesses, our bodies. So in this future world where humans, that I've projected, the enclosure, where humans have pulled back from the wilds, here we have these bodies that we are and that we walk around in and that we interact in. And I was interested in pondering how human attitudes towards the flesh, towards our own flesh or towards the flesh of other animals, how they might change in a totally artificial world.
After finishing the story Mountains of Memory, which is one of the stories that is part of The Engineer of Beasts, I did wonder about what parts of my body I would be willing or not to replace with technology, because there's this android old couple, one with an electronic heart and a synthetic hand. Why do you think people are willing to trade certain parts of their body but not others, like their eyes? Do you think we have a certain wildness that is seen through our eyes or other parts of our body?
Well, the characters in Mountains of Memory and also in The Engineer of Beasts who have not just artificial joints, but artificial organs, that's another case of projecting a trend that was clear when I first wrote the stories and has only become more prominent ever since, because there are more and more, I mean, there are things like face transplants and so forth, which are still experimental and not highly successful, but we are able, through our, again, very astounding medical technology, we are able to pull off surgeries for various kinds of transplants where we're working with organic material, but we're also able to incorporate electronic devices or titanium joints in our bodies that regulate heartbeat or that alleviate some of the symptoms of Parkinson's disease, for example. And again, I'm just as impressed by and grateful for these possibilities as anybody else might be, but I'm looking at the world through spectacles right now, and I have in my ears little devices that amplify sound because, as a 70-year-old male, I have begun to lose acuity in hearing, and I'm grateful for those devices. At the same time, again, I wonder, at what point do we cease to be human? You know, what is distinct? What, if anything, is distinctively human about the human body?
Right. When do we become a machine, or how
much?
Yeah.
When do we become a machine? And that's true whether one's thinking about our body as a whole, or whether one's thinking about one's brain. And another novel that I published that it's now out of print, is called The Invisible Company, and it is not related to the world background of Terrarium or The Engineer of Beasts.
Hmm.
But The Invisible Company explores precisely this question of what constitutes being human. Could we, for example, as many scientists, neuroscientists and computer scientists now suggest, could we somehow download the contents of a human brain into a machine and no longer need the organic, mortal thing we call the human body or the human brain, and then go on with some kind of existence drawing on those neurological patterns? Well, what I did in The Invisible Company, as I did in Terrarium, was just to say, okay, let's suppose that this technology would work. Now, I'm not debating whether it would or not. If it could, let's just assume it could work, that we could transfer the entire contents of a human brain into a machine. Or we could simply take the brain out of the body and put it in some sort of bath or some vat and wire it up and allow it to have virtual experiences through other people's lives. And that's what The Invisible Company does. The group that's called The Invisible Company that gives this novel its title, they're living vicariously through other people. They've been reduced simply to brains and vats, and they're manipulating other people for their own pleasure to vicariously live their experiences.
Going back to Mountains of Memory from your novel, The Engineer of Beasts, after reading it, I also thought about this human element that we have that isn't necessarily part of machines, that the more we possess, the more we discard. How do you think abundance spoils our sense of the specialness in the ordinary? For instance, I read on your blog journal from your website a compelling story about Christmas with your grandchild's gifts and an orange.
Yes. I think it is the case that the more stuff we have, the less precious any of that stuff seems. The story that you allude to from my blog is one my mother told me, that when she was a girl growing up in Chicago, and her father was a physician. They weren't poor, but he was an inner city physician, but they weren't rich either. And what a special treat it was to receive in her stocking at Christmas time an orange, because there weren't oranges in the store. There wasn't air freight between Florida and Illinois. And so for her, an orange, in fact, this continued right through her life, an orange was always a really special thing. Well, you could just take that and think, how many special things do we have in our lives as our lives become more and more cluttered? And what happens is, in a culture of abundance, or I would say a culture of excess, we simply consume or are surrounded by what our desires prompt us to acquire, and those desires are unlimited, and they swamp our ability to take pleasure in them or even to use them. And the physiological consequence of that excess desire with eating is obesity, and the consequence of that excess desire with respect to stuff is that we have many warehouses, M-I-N-I, many warehouses, in every crossroads in America now, where the stuff that will no longer fit in people's houses or garages is stored away so that they can buy new stuff to put in their house. And the accumulation of things makes it harder and harder for us to pay attention to what really matters in our lives.
And there's this sense of loss in many of your stories about nature. For instance, there's one called Clear Cut, where there's this sycamore tree that this couple, these two folks who actually become a couple, a nurse and x-ray technician from the night shift, they appreciate the dreams that roost in the sycamore's boughs. I wondered about that plot situation, and also a quote that you've written about before from John Muir, who says that nothing dollarable is safe, however guarded. How do you deal with the grief of nature's value cut down to only its economic worth?
Anyone who loves the earth and its creatures and its wild things, its free-flowing rivers, its butterflies, its birds, anyone who loves a place or loves a species has to feel some degree of grief in our own time because so much is being lost. One of the concerns that I haven't mentioned yet but that drove the writing of some of these stories is the rapid extinction of species caused by human destruction of habitat, the cutting down of forests, the draining of wetlands, the plowing of prairies, and so forth. And literally our fellow creatures are disappearing. Not just individual animals, for example, but entire species. And anyone who's aware of this and who loves the abundance and the variety of life on Earth, the true kind of abundance, not what you see in a store, but what you see in a rainforest or what you see in a meadow, that abundance, anybody who loves that has to feel grief about how much of it we're destroying and how much is being lost. The story that you referred to, Clear Cut, is, I suppose, another parable. This couple, both of whom work in a hospital, both have a power, an unusual power, to perceive dreams that roost in trees in the daytime and then leave the trees and go down into the city and inhabit people's dreams at night. So characters that show up in dreams, you know, a pirate or a witch or whatever the classic characters might be, roost in the trees. And as the trees are cut down, there are fewer and fewer places for the dream creatures to roost, and therefore there are fewer and fewer dreams available to the people down in the city. And as that happens, people's sleep becomes more and more troubled. They become more and more anxious and distressed, and the level of violence, the level of disorder, the level of madness in the city constantly increases. And it's a parable, but it's a parable that I think could be documented scientifically. That is, the more we destroy the greater than human world, whether it's forests or whether, you know, paving outward from the city center and just constant development and sprawl, the more we diminish the abundance of other species, other creatures, the more we are turned in upon ourselves. And so many of our ailments, the levels of suicide, the levels of depression, the levels of anxiety. So many of our ailments, I think, are tied to our rather neurotic isolation within human worlds and our being separated from or being cut off from the greater than human world. There's sanity to be derived from recognizing that we are creatures wholly dependent on and derived from a greater natural world, and ultimately from the universe. There's sanity in that, and there's a kind of insanity in imagining that the human world, what humans have made, is by itself sufficient for a full life.
And after finishing your book, I really came to believe that the sycamore is a perfect representation of your writing here, that the sycamore's bark is a camouflage pattern of peeling patches, and the trunks are broad, solid foundations. They're visible from afar. While they grow quickly, they can live for hundreds of years.
Yes.
I appreciate your book of sci-fi stories and know that books like it hold our dreams in its pages. So, Scott, thank you so much for being on Book Central with me.
Thanks for inviting me, Chris. It's been a great pleasure to talk with you.
Scott Russell Sanders is the author of Dancing in Dreamtime. Thank you for listening to Book Central. I'm your host, Chris Viviora. Our theme music was composed by Will Pett. This program is supported by Humanities Iowa and the National Endowment for the Humanities. The views and opinions expressed by this program do not necessarily reflect those of Humanities Iowa or the National Endowment for the Humanities.